Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the OIS China Energy Programme. My name is Michal Maidan, I head China research at OIS, and I'm also co-editor of the Oxford Energy Forum on the geopolitics of energy in China that we published on the 8th of August 2023. This podcast is part of a series drawing on the very rich contributions we had to the forum. The idea behind the forum was to think about China's role in the geopolitics of energy, both fossil fuels and new energy supply chains, from China's perspective, but also to give a view from other regions around the world. Today's podcast is the second in our series, and it features two contributions. The first by Neil Beveridge, who is Managing Director at Bernstein Research, who asked in the forum, is China's gas dream over? So we will first be discussing the outlook for gas in China in the context of rising energy security and geopolitical concerns. My second guest on this podcast is Sergei Vakulenko, who is a non-resident scholar at the Carnegie Russia-Eurasia Center. And Sergei and I will dive into China-Russia energy relations more specifically. But first of all, Neil, hello and welcome to the OIS podcast.
Hello, Michelle. It's great to join you.
So let's start with a bit of context. With all the volatility in global gas markets following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we've seen higher prices, we've seen a tightening of the market as Europe soaks up more LNG. In China, the discourse has really been talking up the role of coal in the energy mix. What does that mean for gas? Do you think that the gas dream is over?
I don't think it's over, but certainly we've hit a point of certainly lower growth. If you remember, the target that China has set is for gas to reach 15% of the energy mix by 2030. You know, we think that implies at least a 50% increase in demand from current levels. If you look at gas penetration in China, it's around 10% of the energy mix. So to hit that 15% target, you know, gas consumption has to increase by about 50%, you know, even if there's no growth in overall energy demand. So there's no change in that target, but certainly, you know, over the last few years, you know, we've seen growth slow down. In fact, last year was, you know, probably the worst year in 30 years as we saw, you know, gas demand, you know, go negative. And we're seeing a pretty slow recovery in gas demand this year against fairly weak Chinese economic recovery from the COVID virus. So, you know, I think that, you know, the slower growth that we see in the market today certainly is disappointing, but I don't think you can extrapolate this to a permanent rate of slower growth. I do think that you'll see growth reaccelerate again as we start to see the Chinese economy recover, which may take a few years from now. But I think you'll also see it recover as you see increased gas supplies from 2025 onwards, when we're going to see a lot more LNG supply reach the market. So I certainly don't think it's over, but certainly, you know, slower growth for now.
And just to be clear, back in the day when we talked about the 15%, that used to be equated to around 600 BCM. Do you think that's still roughly the number? And which sectors do you think will drive demand growth?
I think that's right. I think it is around 600 BCM. I think if you look at, you know, what's driving demand historically, you know, industry had been a big driver of overall growth. You know, it's about 50% of the gas market. The industrial sector is much bigger when you look at other markets. I think going forward, I think you'll still see, you know, industry play a significant role in gas demand growth, but we'll see a greater contribution from probably commercial and also from heating, I think, as you continue to see coal to gas switching.
Now, that context of heating is interesting, as we've just seen price increases, or at least a change in pricing formula that has led to price increases in residential gas in 20-odd cities in China. What does that do you think, for the demand outlook?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this has been a long, you know, overdue reform. I mean, traditionally, residential prices have been, you know, lower than, you know, industrial gas prices. Usually, it's the other way around. You know, in most Western economies, large gas consumers typically get a lower tariff than, you know, small consumers of gas. So I think these reforms have been long overdue. I think it's going to lead certainly to more, you know, market-driven market in China and will certainly help gas distributors to build out networks further. For the consumer, you know, I think demand's going to be fairly inelastic to this. I don't think there'll be, you know, a huge amount of, you know, switching into other fuels. I think the consumer will largely have to absorb this increase. So I don't expect it's going to have a significantly negative impact on demand.
Interesting. But sort of you do see it increasing the supply side of the picture, which is a nice segue into, I guess, the supply dynamics, because with that kind of growth into China, where are supplies going to come from? And I guess which of the supply sources offer China the best hedge against what they see as rising geopolitical tensions and, you know, most unprecedented and volatile external environment that they're facing?
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, energy security has really crept up the agenda in China, and there's certainly a strong push for the China oil majors to, you know, increase supply. But there's also an increased pressure on Chinese oil majors to improve returns. And so if you look at what China's likely to be able to achieve in terms of domestic gas consumption growth, you know, we think it's going to be able to grow supply by about 5%, you know, based upon, you know, what we see from the leading oil majors, PetroChina, Sinopec, Sinopec. When you aggregate their, you know, capex plans over the next 5 years, you know, you can come out with a number for about 5% growth. And by 2030, you know, we think roughly half the market is going to be supplied by domestic gas. A lot of this is coming from three key regions, you know, Sichuan, Ordos, and Xinjiang. A lot of the gas is fairly, you know, tight. There is shale. It's a relatively small part of China's overall gas mix, maybe around 10%. And we haven't really seen, you know, the breakthroughs in shale in China that we've seen in the US. So I think China's going to be able to continue growing supply, but it's, you know, unlikely to achieve a rate higher than, let's say, the mid-single digits.
And interestingly, the natural gas development report that was released a few weeks ago by the NEA did talk about that 50% threshold for imports, which I think was one of the first or maybe second time that they've made that explicit. So they're clearly banking on more domestic production. I mean, how can we assess the potential? Do you think that the risks are skewed to the downside or to the upside in terms of your forecast and the ability of China to increase production?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that it's unlikely we're to see rates significantly, you know, higher than 5%. The reason I say that is because, it's not just a question of increasing the supply. There's the infrastructure that really has to be built out with this. I mean, we're talking, you know, basins which are 2,000 to 4,000 kilometers away from the eastern coast. And so Pipe China needs to, you know, build out the pipeline network to accommodate this. So, you know, even if, you know, supply, you know, could come, you know, more rapidly to the market, you know, you've got that infrastructure that needs to be built out along with it. I guess if there is an area that we could see a surprise in, maybe offshore China. You know, Sinopec have been making progress with deeper gas discoveries in the Bohai Bay, which is traditionally been an oil basin, but they are encountering deeper gas discoveries there. And that gas could potentially be brought on, you know, more quickly. But again, you know, Chinese companies are very good at planning ahead. And, you know, I think the, you know, sort of growth rates of, you know, 5%, I think probably are, you know, a reasonable sort of estimate. So I don't see, you know, a significant amount of upside, you know, to those numbers.
And that does imply then that China still needs imports. Is it the government? Is it the companies? And how do they think about the balance between pipeline and LNG? What are the factors that will push them towards one or the other? You talked about infrastructure, commercial choices. What does that look like?
Yeah, so I mean, if you look at the, you know, China's policy on imports, you know, there's been a fundamental, you know, number one rule, which is diversification. So there's a very strong focus to see not just a diversification between pipeline gas supply and LNG, but also if you look at the countries supplying the pipeline gas and LNG, as diversified a supply base as possible. So I think that's the primary driver. I think secondly is obviously, you know, pricing. Where does China feel that it can get the best, you know, overall deals, and, you know, certainly where they can get equity, upstream equity as part of supply, you know, they will do that. But I think that, you know, by 2030, I think the aim is that roughly half the gas supply will come from imports. And I think there's a preference to kind of keep it, you know, equally mixed between, you know, pipeline gas and an LNG. I think when it comes to pipeline gas, the big project that we're seeing really happening right now is Central Asia Line D. So that has been built, you know, as we speak. PetroChina have started construction on that. So I think that the pipeline will be around 25, you know, 30 BCM, you know, possibly starting up in, you know, 2-3 years time. Of course, Power of Siberia 1 is ramping up. The Sakhalin pipeline is obviously under construction following the agreement with Xi and Putin, you know, earlier this year. And then I think on the pipeline side, I think the big question is really Power of Siberia 2. You know, this is a project which really I think Russia is pushing hard for now, given, you know, what's happened in Europe. You know, China is clearly the alternative option for Russia, you know, if it can't sell gas into Europe. China, I think, is being somewhat circumspect on this project. I think the, you know, from what we see, you know, while China may want this gas, I think to sign up to any major deal right now at a time between the time when we've got the ongoing conflict with Russia and Ukraine, I think would be seen very negatively by, you know, China's, you know, European partners. So my sense is that Russia may want to do this, but I think it's unlikely that China will sign up for a deal until we see a resolution to the Russia-Ukraine war, which means that, you know, any deals really done in the short term are probably going to be more centered around LNG.
Interesting that Central Asia Line D has made such a, as far as I'm concerned, I think a quick advance. It was sort of dormant, and I think I at least lost hope that it would happen. And now the fact that it is starting does change, I think, the dynamics of Power of Siberia 2. You talk about this as well in your contribution, and Sergei, who we are talking to later, also has that notion that while Russia really needs this and is backed into a corner, it is hard to see this come off the ground now. And I think Central Asia Line D does change that balance. You talked about diversification, and I guess when you compare gas to oil, there aren't as many sources of supply that China can turn to. And when you think about LNG and future volumes, there are a number of exporting countries, but fundamentally, most of the volumes are going to come from the US, Australia, Qatar, and Russia. And the US and Australia are potentially complicated from a geopolitical perspective. So how do you think China manages that sort of LNG reliance part of the equation?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that certainly, you know, Qatar, you know, is one of the key projects now for China. I mean, you saw Sinopec enter into that 30-year agreement that extends beyond 2050. I think it's one of the few LNG contracts to do so. And, you know, Sinopec have got a share, I think, in the Qatar project. So Qatar has been, you know, extremely important, you know, for China. But, you know, again, on this principle of diversification, you know, they don't want to put all their eggs in one basket and will want to see, you know, further diversification. When you look at, you know, Asia, there's really limited options. You know, Scarborough is likely to be pushed more to Japan and Korea. We saw Tokyo Gas sign up Woodside earlier this week. I think PNG could be one option. Certainly, you know, China has developed much closer relationships there. And with the development of Papua LNG, I think that's one project you could certainly see, you know, China emerge as a strong buyer. And I think for the US, you know, I think it's clearly a complicated relationship. And, you know, China, you know, will not want to be overly dependent on the US. But maybe, you know, there is the, you know, opportunity for, you know, some volumes, you know, to be contracted, you know, with China. Certainly, we've seen deals done, you know, despite the relationship between China and the US, could see some volumes, you know, coming into, coming into China. I think for Russia, you know, technically, I think it's going to be challenging to see significant LNG expansion, you know, just given some of the, you know, technical restrictions. So I think Russian LNG more problematic, and particularly if they're ultimately going to go for more, you know, pipeline gas over the long term. So yeah, there's less options, I think, for China than certainly in the past.
And I guess we're coming up to the end of our time, but if I can sneak in one more question, I guess when the Chinese companies go to approach their LNG supply deals, to what extent, to the extent that we can simplify this, do they approach it with a commercial lens, and how much of it is a strategic view on diversification, on, again, supply security? How do you think they think about those contracts?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's not the free-for-all that it was back in the day, and it is, you know, very much coordinated by NDRC. I think there's certainly, prior to any deal, there's an understanding as to what the, you know, parameters are, what countries are acceptable, and, you know, the Chinese SOEs are really, you know, going out to kind of get the best deal possible. I mean, I don't think NDRC is mandating, you know, which contracts have to get done, but I certainly think they're deciding which companies are going to negotiate on what deals, and, you know, which countries are acceptable and which are not. And ultimately, before any deal signed, certainly NDRC will have to sign off on it. So I think there are, you know, some very strict controls there. But, you know, we've also got some private companies, you know, coming in as well. We've got some of the gas distribution companies like ENN, Sierra Gas, China Gas. They're also doing, you know, deals, you know, albeit on a smaller scale. And I think there you've probably got more of a commercial driver to these deals, you know, less state involvement, but certainly you know, NDRC will need to bless any deal that's done prior to, you know, full signing of the contract.
Neil, I mean, I could spend hours speaking to you, but I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there for today. But I'd like to thank you very much for joining me, and also for your extremely insightful contribution to the Oxford Energy Forum.
Thank you very much, Michelle. It was a pleasure to join you today, and look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Sergey, welcome to the podcast. In the first part of this podcast, we discussed the outlook for gas in China. Of course, Russian flows of gas are a key part of that. In your contribution to the forum, you write about the history of Russia-China gas relations and specifically how they've changed in 2022. In your view, is China the biggest winner from the Russian invasion of Ukraine from a gas supply perspective?
Indeed, Russia has put itself in a corner. When it comes to gas, it had to leave European market. Well, it decided to leave European market, trying to corner it. Didn't work too well. It had to offer its gas to China. For now, the gas that was sold to Europe beforehand is locked in. There is no pipeline connecting Yamal Peninsula, the main Russian gas producing province, to China. Russia is contemplating power of Siberia 2 that would bring gas from Yamal to China. And China would have a monopsony negotiating position. This power of Siberia 2 pipeline has been on the drawing board for a very long time. China was a bit uneasy with the whole idea of the pipeline, with the whole idea that it might have to compete with Europe for the resource. Now it's not the case anymore. Russia had more gas in Yamal than it could possibly sell to Europe, so it was looking for additional outlet to it. China was a logical source. Now Russia can't use European pricing as an anchor for Chinese pricing anymore, for example, and we have to rely on Power of Siberia 1 pricing formula, which is not that lucrative for Russia. So, yes, Russia is currently in a corner, and China is a bit of a savior. It's probably indeed a greatest winner.
So if you're saying that Russia is in the corner and China has all the bargaining power, why do you think that China is not capitalizing on this more actively?
Traditionally, China was pursuing a policy of a balanced supply portfolio. So it was reluctant to rely on a single or a dominant supplier. And with Power of Siberia 1 destined to come to 38 billion cubic meters per annum, maybe even 50 billion cubic meters per annum, the problem was a feeling that it's already too much. So China was deciding that it would have a balanced portfolio of pipeline supplies from Central Asia and Russia, and Russian LNG as well. Russia is also a large LNG supplier to China, Russian companies have stakes in Yamal LNG projects, both the first one and the Arctic LNG second one. That was that balanced approach. That's what China was pursuing. And now for China to decide that it would indeed agree on 50 BCM additional billion cubic meters per annum supply from Russia, so the total would come to close to 100 BCM, that's a departure from its usual approach. However, for China, it's also important because this supply route from Russia to China, it is supposed to go through Mongolia, but Mongolia is an easy transit state for both countries. But it's a safe supply route from the security standpoint. So if there is any tension between China and maritime powers, if somehow LNG supplies through Malacca Strait and through Strait of Taiwan become vulnerable, then this overland supply is a lifeline. But then again, China is in a position where it can just wait and see, stake Russian gas suppliers against Turkmenistan gas suppliers and make them fight for who's getting the first contract from China and make them fight each other who is going to offer the best pricing and offtake conditions and take-or-pay conditions and like. So China is in a favorable position.
I mean, we've just heard from Neil that Central Asia Line D is underway. But on balance, do you think Power of Siberia 2, I know this is a difficult question, but on balance, do you think it happens?
Russia is keen to make it happen. It's beneficial and useful for China, so I think it will.
And I know you've written about this elsewhere for the Carnegie publications. Where do you think, as much as we can know and assess, where do you think the pricing will be roughly and how competitive will it be? Is it indexed to LNG or is it indexed to Turkmen gas?
It seems like Chinese pricing formulae are very traditional. That at all the contracts China uses with Burma, Myanmar, Central Asia and Russia, it has the 9-3-3 pricing formula. So for 3 months, they look at 9 months oil price average 3 months prior. So it's crude linked. Correlation is very strong. So leads me to believe that it's not tied to LNG. It's tied to crude price. This is the pricing formula on PS2, and I would think Chinese opening position to Russia would be, let's use the same pricing formula on PS1 the two countries are already using for PS2. This is not a very lucrative price. China pays Russia less for its gas than it pays to Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. It would be substantially less than what Russia used to get from Europe in normal market conditions. There were times when Chinese contract was more lucrative to Russia than European contracts. European contracts lately were spot-linked. And during COVID, when all the energy markets were overfilled, European gas markets were really in doldrums and the prices were really low. Chinese contract was paying better than European spot-linked contracts. But usually, Chinese contract is less profitable than European sales. And of course, there would be a very substantial transportation charge. However, this Yamal gas, upstream cost of it is pretty much negligible. You have mammoth-sized fields that are already developed with all the infrastructure in place. Effectively, all the cost that Russia is going to incur in there is just variable lifting cost. That's it. And with that consideration in mind, Russia would still be getting some rent, not a lot, but at least some rent from the sale of gas to China through Power Siberia 2, even at Power Siberia 1 pricing formula.
Interesting. And this notion of some rent, I guess, is replicated in oil markets too, right? We've seen an increased flow from Russia to China, and not just in gas. So can we shift gears a little bit, and can you talk us through how the energy relationship has changed and is changing more broadly?
Right. Well, you've mentioned oil. Until 2022, Russia had roughly a third of its oil exports going eastwards through ESPO, East Siberia Pacific Ocean Pipeline. Part of it was going directly to China through a pipeline link. Part of it was going to Port of Kozhbino and then to China. Most of it was going to China. It could go to South Korea, Japan, but most of it was going to China. However, since 2022, all the crude that Russia has been sending from Baltics and Black Sea to Europe, which was its main buyer, shifted to India and China, mostly to India, but to China as well. China started to receive Russian crude. Looks like that some of that crude in Chinese trade statistics is dressed as Malaysian. The volumes are substantially higher than what Malaysia produces, so it got to be something else. Most likely it's Russia. Discounts on that Russian crude delivered to Chinese ports were not that high, and to start with, well, they were quite high in June, July 2022, when Russia was desperate to rebuild its market positions, to rearrange its flows and so on. Since then, they've diminished quite substantially, probably 5% discount or something like that. So we can say that China earns that much on that trade. However, shipping costs, of course, are much higher. That crude has to go around pretty much all of Eurasia. Now, Russia is trying to check whether a northern sea route would be a feasible path. As we speak, few tankers are going eastwards through East Siberian Sea towards the Bering Strait, because now is the best time to go through. Ice is cleared, but of course, global warming also helps to keep that route ice-free. That would shorten shipping distances substantially, and Russia has been growing its production capacity along Pacific Ocean. But still, the bulk of Russian production goes via pipelines from West Siberia to Baltic and Black Sea and has to go all the way through Gibraltar. It goes from the Baltics, so Suez Canal, around India. It's a long track.
Are there any limitations in terms of the fleet? There's a lot of talk about, right, the dark fleet and the sort of physical shipping infrastructure. Is that a limitation for Russian exports?
There are two issues. One of them is purely physical. If your shipping route is 4 or 5 times longer than it used to be, you have to place 4 to 5 times more tankers on it to keep it going. Russia needed more tankers. Apparently, there were more tankers. Shipping rates spiked again in 22, then reverted to mean recently. But also, there were commercial and political issues, price cap issues and such. Some shippers were not too keen to work with Russia, the traditional traders that quite often were organizing shipping as well, decided not to deal in Russian crude. Interestingly enough, U.S. Garant was trying to convince traders like Stasco or Trafigura or Gunvor to get back into Russian crude oil, so not to leave it all to the hands of shady operators.
Where, of course, the risk of spillage and accidents and issues is much higher, or could potentially be higher.
It's not really a spillage. It's more that U.S. Garant probably prefers these deals to be in as a light shade of gray as possible. They probably still would be somewhere in twilight zone, but preferably closer to the light sources than the complete darkness. Yes, these operators use older tankers, but it's still 15-year-old, 17-year-old. It's not that old. Most of them are double hull. So I don't think it's the risk of spillage, but, commercial considerations, having cash flows under, if not controlled, then line of sight, I think these are the reasons. And hopes that if those operators serve Russian trade, there are more hopes of having price cap enforced. And of course, there's absolutely no hopes with Dubai or Fujairah-based traders with payments done in dirhams or yuans.
Which actually brings us nicely to the next question, this kind of lighter or darker shade of grey. We hear a lot about China and Russia moving away from trade in US dollar or euros to other currencies, all this talk about the de-dollarization, not to go as far as to kind of the petro-yuan, but of course a lot of talk about the petro-yuan. And of course, China has helped Russia sanction-proof or avoid sanctions and create this sanction-busting regime. How do you think this plays out in global energy flows and perhaps even sort of beyond in geopolitical considerations? But also, I guess, fundamentally, how important is it?
I think on the larger scheme of things, yuan has strong chances to become an international currency one day, probably sooner than later, just like US dollar has become an international currency in the early 20th century. And after World War I, more of the world trade started to be done in US dollar than in French franc or British pound, reflecting the relative strength of US economy vis-a-vis war-shattered European economies. Now, China is becoming an ascendant global economic power, so it's only natural that yuan would become also an international currency of commerce. I think Chinese central bank, still People's Bank of China, still hasn't made its mind on whether it wants it, how soon it wants it. Having an international currency, having a currency that circulates offshore, having a currency that serves as a saving currency for offshore investors is actually a huge headache for a monetary authority. It creates quite a lot of power for the country. It allows for monetization of currency, as the US does, but it's also a great headache. So I think Bank of China has been reluctant on that account. Now things are taking their own course. Russia switched to yuan because of a political necessity. Most of Russian-Chinese trade is currently in yuans. But interestingly enough, as rupees are not an international currency, it's probably not going to become one soon. It's not particularly easily convertible currency either. So currently, much of Russian-Indian oil trade starts to be conducted in yuans more and more. Apparently, dirhams is a relatively shallow currency. There's not too much of it. And then if we see a situation that China is a major buyer of Russian crude, there is a growing hub and pricing point in the Far East, probably yuan-priced crude purchases become larger and larger, we could probably see that prices start to get quoted in yuans, that Chinese buyers start to insist on paying in yuans. And this would indeed lead to internationalization of yuan as a currency, and yuan becoming a currency of oil trade. Interesting enough, 50 years ago, US was a major buyer of Gulf oil. That's not the case anymore. China is a major buyer of Gulf oil as well. And one could also ask how important is US dollar to the Gulf countries these days?
I mean, Sergey, we could go on talking for hours, but I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. I would like to thank you for joining me today. I would also like to thank you for your contribution to the Oxford Energy Forum.
Thank you.
A reminder to our listeners that the Oxford Energy Forum on China and the Geopolitics of Energy is available on our website, so feel free to download it. We hope you enjoy reading it and listening to this and the other podcasts in this series on the Oxford Energy Forum. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information at oxfordenergy.org.